and fled the office. The man looked at me in terms of, what have you done? He left the office. And I waited to be fired. To this day, I'm not even sure Larry knows that story. But needless to say, take notes about things you will likely forget, or jot a thought here and there that you can go back to at a later point in time. The thing I would object to is if your nose is largely in a notebook as you're taking copious notes. Because what you will find is, like most classes, the copious notes you took are just not useful. And so take the notes that help you prompt your thinking about demographics or details that would be of some help. Another issue that, again, but bear with me, timeliness. Don't be late. Don't you hate physicians who make you wait 45 minutes, even if you know they have reasonable reasons for doing so? There's a sense of your time is more important than mine, and it already sets up a structure of irritation that's already there by the fact they're ambivalent. Don't add to it by being late. Now, again, there will be lateness, but if there is, two things I would do. First, apologize. But in one sense, before you apologize, process what might have been provoked by your tardiness. Don't apologize quickly, because in many cases what that comes across as is water off a duck's back. I've apologized. Now, if you have any issue with me, it's your fault, not mine. I've done the right thing. I've asked forgiveness, or I've said I'm sorry. Now, the fact you're angry or hurt or discouraged or it's provoked issues, now you're not likely to deal with. Why? Because I've already asked your forgiveness. So that's why I would rather, if I'm 10 minutes late, sit down with a client and basically say, I've been 10 minutes late. Can you tell me what's been provoked by that? Has that provoked anything for you? And then in the context, the person might say, no, I just figured there was something that had to be dealt with. And then I'd look at them and I'd basically say, that's true, and I apologize for having put you at a point of inconvenience. So timeliness is very, very, very important. Things like, do you offer food and drink to clients? I think categorically no. Do never, ever offer food to a client. Why? A brief story. In my first year of counseling, a client who I'd worked with two or three sessions came in, and he was a man probably in his early 30s, still living with his mother, in many respects, a very, very constrained, docile, quiet, passive man. And he came in one day. His mother always brought him. And his mother was, for whatever reason, I put words to this, a large, and Larry used the term already, so I'll just kind of refer back to it, had a certain job of the hut style of relating. There was just a mood of sucking into a vortex. And I'd met her, chatted with her a few times, and her son would come back to my office, and oftentimes it would be very hard interactions in terms of, well, tell me about the week. Have a good week. And we might go, I might ask 10 questions before he'd respond even with a yes or no. So that gives you a bit of a picture. He came in one time and he had a bag of cookies. And we sat down and he handed me a cookie, or handed me the bag of cookies. And I took them and he said to me, my mother made them. She made them for you. Sessions had not been going well anyway. But for whatever reason, I took one of the cookies and I bit into it, and it was a very dry, extremely dry, Sahara-type dry peanut butter cookie. And it didn't exactly melt in my mouth. It crumbled. And as it crumbled, a piece got stuck. Got stuck in the back of my throat. I don't know if you've ever been in that position where you can feel it stuck and you kind of begin to but every time I move my esophagus, it got more deeply stuck. And I began to cough more, and rather than take the story any longer, it really got stuck to a point where I was having a hard time breathing. And I began to turn a slight shade of red. I began to perspire, and then it got to a point where I couldn't even get up. I was choking so hard. I fell to my knees and to my hands. And the only way to get it up at that point was to use your imagination, folks. So I threw the cookie up on the floor, and at that point I'm drenching wet. I'm red. I'm utterly humiliated. And I cleaned up the carpet and I sat back in my chair, and he's sitting there. And he looked at me and he said, "Shall I tell my mother you didn't like the cookies?" I made an oath that day, and that was, I will never eat with a client. I will never, ever eat in a counseling situation again in my life. So that's my argument as to, sure, offer them coffee, offer them drinks, offer anything that can't get stuck. Now, on the other hand, if you're chatting with someone at a restaurant, this happened with a good friend of mine not long ago. He asked if we could have a talk, and I said, sure. He said, I really have some tough things to talk about with you. And I said, well, okay, be willing to talk. We went to a Chinese restaurant, and he ordered something that I wanted. And I thought, he's never going to be able to finish this. So I ordered a small dish, and sure enough, within just 5 minutes into it, he just couldn't eat his meal. And so then, never mind. Other things that need to be clarified in terms of mechanics, things, for example, when are you going to meet? This is particularly true if you're working with a person outside of an office setting. I think it is a big mistake if you're meeting with a friend to kind of have a mood of, well, why don't you come over whenever and we'll talk. That already sets up a level of, and I don't know the right word to put here, but a level of lack of seriousness, probably a better word for that. But I want a more serious environment. So even if I knew this is a good friend and we're just going to sit around and talk, but it's going to be talking about personal matters, I'd want to say to them, why don't you come over at 2 o'clock? And then, very importantly, I'd want to add, and I'll have enough time to talk with you until about 3:15. Don't allow it to be this wide open parameter, in part for the client's sake. I mean, nobody wants to talk about all the issues in their life endlessly. And if they do, there's something very wrong. So put time parameters. And you can say around 3:15 so that you have 3:15 to 3:30. But don't go on to 4, 4:35. Put some time constraint. Now, that will be true in an office setting without much work. But as well, I would want to clarify with the person, what are we meeting for? I'd want that to be up front before we ever sat down. And if I can again put it well, I want to add, I want to ask the person, are you wanting to think things through on a very short-term basis? In other words, you want one time to kind of think this through? Because if I get into talking with you about certain matters in your life, what if we discover there's a whole lot more to be addressed? I need to know, I guess, before we start surgery, what your intention is. And that is not only time parameters, I'll meet with you from 1:15 to 3:15 or something like that, but also, what's your intention? Are you really wanting to work on your life? If so, you're really asking me to kind of take a role of being a counselor, I guess. Really kind of, again, at this point, not so much a mutual, you deal with me, I'm dealing with you, but you're really asking for me to interact with you about certain issues in your life. Make it that clear. And also make it clear in terms of, and if there are reasons to go on, is that something you want to consider? You don't need to make that decision before we meet the first time, but I want that to be in your mind so that I have some clarity about the nature of our relationship. Let that be the final point about mechanics. Let there be clarity about the nature of the relationship. And especially in the context of kind of loosey-goosey friendship type things, you need clarity. Otherwise, you're going to get killed. I don't mean physically, but you're going to be caught in all the ambivalence without some level of structure. Third point, the mood. To do this quickly, let me just kind of state a few things that I think would be obvious, but I hope to underscore. First, I hope there's a mood of warmth. Don't work with a person if you don't want to. Oh, that's so obvious, but again, let me stress that I'm dealing tonight with the obvious. Don't minister to anyone because they'll know it. If you don't want to work with them, then don't say no. Don't be in a position where you obligate yourself because your client will feel it. And they'll feel it at some level because you have been boxed into saying yes when you really meant no. And therefore there'll be an absence of warmth. An absence, frankly, of desire. Do you really want to work with them? And if the answer is, you know, I do, but I don't, your client will feel it. And therefore, you need to think through when someone asks you to talk, be it for 5 minutes, an hour, or 20 sessions, you must honestly evaluate whether you desire to do so. The issue of warmth is, do I really want to? Do I desire to work with you? Second point, in terms of mood. I hope there's kind of a mood of directness. When I sit down with a person, I don't tend to chit-chat. Well, how was your day? How are the kids? When it's clear that we're in a context that you're asking me to be of help in terms of thinking through things in your life, then I think it's far more respectful. If the client wants to chit-chat, don't be impolite. But on the other hand, I think it's far better to just get to it by asking something like, how can I be of help? Or what's on your mind today? Or where to? It does have a certain abruptness. But with warmth, then the directness isn't crude. It's just a matter of, I'm really here for serious business. Third point, and this is the hardest to explain and probably the easiest to misinterpret, but I think there should be a mood of weariness about you. That may come very naturally. But let me explain what I mean. Isn't that you stayed up all last night? A mood of weariness, I mean by that, I've been in the battle before, and I have no joy to enter into another one. I have no joy of being insightful in your life. I remember the first 3, 5, 10, probably the first 35 years of my work with people. It's still a factor, in other words. There's a certain joy in being insightful, of having a client go, huh, and to be able to say, uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. I was helpful, wasn't I? I saw something that mere mortals don't see. You see, a mood of weariness basically says, I have no glory in battle. I take no joy in disrupting your life. I take no joy in sort of being a counselor. Because I've kind of had that beaten out of me by my failures. I've been beaten, in one sense, to a pulp by my own sin. And therefore, a mood of, I'm on my second or third tour in Vietnam. I'm not on my first. And therefore, if I'm here, it is because of a calling. If I'm here, it's because I can do nothing but what I'm doing. I've already attempted to escape ship, to go E-W-O-L. I want out. And if you can get out, then you take it. And therefore, if you're there, you're not there because it's kind of neat to be a counselor. or because, I really want meaning in my life, and I find more meaning talking with people than selling shoes at, Kresge's. That may be true. You might have more meaning than selling shoes, but the fact is, if you can do anything but counsel, do it. But if you have found there's a fire that burns within you and you cannot but do that, then your mood should be one that's weary. And that is, I don't need to be helpful. Counselors that need to be helpful will be sensed quickly by a client. And they will use that against you to the nth degree. If a client knows you need their money, you're in bad shape. If a client knows you need their support or they're adding to your reputation. And let me tell you, the first time you have someone who's famous who wants to see you. And remember, fame is always decided or defined by the size of the pond you happen to be in. So the person who's famous may just be the person who lives next door to your pastor. I mean, they're not people who are well-known nationally, but when you are talking to somebody who matters because they know someone who matters to you, then you'll begin to realize that it's hard to be weary with people. You want to be helpful. To the degree you want to be helpful, you won't. To the degree you need to be helpful, you won't. And that's why the mood, in this sense, must be one of warmth, of directness, of weariness. Finally, fourth, what is the methodology? Well, the goal that I have as I work with people is to somehow move the discussion from the presenting problem. And again, please recall that the presenting problem is usually framed in terms of a situation, an external situation that has undermined their life, a divorce, a depression of some sort, a failure in a job, an affair, etc., etc. Or it's defined as an internal symptom of a internal reality like an addiction or inferiority or a sense of despair. And therefore, the presenting problem will be, generally speaking, something you can do nothing about. What can you really do about externals? Nothing. What can you do about internals like insecurity? Nothing. Therefore, the task in the first session, putting it very simply, is you must refocus the problem so that it is something that you can work on and is legitimate to work on. That you can work on and is legitimate to work on. And ultimately, even though it won't be put this way to your client, the only legitimate thing to work on is their pursuit of God. Now, you can't say that to people because, first of all, they won't hear you. Second of all, if they do, they'll misunderstand you. Third, they've come for a definitive purpose, and that is the presenting problem. That must be respected. And so the art, the skill, the talent of counseling is somehow shaping the presenting problem, hear the next phrase, without disrespecting it. Shaping it into issues that allow the person to face their internal world toward others and God. And therefore, my task is to move toward a disruption of their desire. In other words, a disruption of their desire opens the door to a very deep sense of their own sorrow that they don't want to face. I equally want to disrupt something about their understanding of sin, which opens the door eventually, certainly not quickly, to the categories of repentance. And in turn, I want to begin to disrupt something of the chaos that they're avoiding in their life, and therefore open their door, open their heart to something about the relationship with God, and therefore repentance, faith, hope, and love. That's my desire. I want to begin to use the presenting problem to get to the issues of the soul. Now, that's an obvious sentence, but in part, how in the world do you do it? Here are four transitions I want to make in the first session. Four transitions I want to make. First of all, I want to go from the external to the internal. Even when a person's describing their internal world, that is, I'm depressed, or I'm sexually addicted, or I have problems with inferiority, generally speaking, they're still talking about it in an external fashion. I want to move from the exterior to the interior, and I cannot do so without entanglement in scenes. S-C-E-N-E, is that right? Scenes. I can't work with a person in abstraction. One of the simplest ways for me to talk about it, and I don't like doing this, but let me do it anyway. I can say to you a sentence. August 11th, my father died of cancer. And I frankly feel, as I say that, nothing. I mean, not much. I'm not going to do it now. But if you were to ask me what it was like after I returned from Europe to go into the funeral parlor, to walk up to the casket where my father lay, I can see that scene right now. And it's a very different internal world the moment I put words to it. I mean, I can say August 11th, my father died, and there's an abstraction to it. It's true. But there's no sense of connection of my heart to it. But if I say to you, let me tell you about the scene, then there's something within me that begins to come, I don't want to use the word alive, but comes to a point of intense passion. And therefore, what I want to do with people is not presume that anyone's going to give me their heart in a first session. They're watching me too much. They're not sure they're even going to give me the real problem yet. Don't ever anticipate a client's going to tell you what they really want to talk about. Not in the first session or maybe in the first 20. Nevertheless, what they're really saying is, can I trust you with my heart? Can I trust you with my soul? Are you stronger than me? And are you more tender than me? In which case, what I want to begin to do, not that it's going to be done extensively, it only is the hint. So when I say the word hint, I mean a little bit of a transition from external to internal. And the internal world will be first put into words of feelings. And therefore, I want to go from the external to the internal, that is to the internal world of feelings. But I want to begin talking about feelings with them, feelings about the presenting problem or feelings about the context in a way that does two things, that catches any glimmer of passion. And wherever there's a glimmer of passion, there's a moist eye, there's a stutter in their words, there's any sense of there's a reality here, then you pursue it. You follow it. On the other hand, if there isn't, then what you must do is to reflect words back to them that goes farther than their feelings but begins to put words to their inner ache. In other words, the second major transition is going from feelings to an inner ache. And let me promise you, do you know you have one? Well, if you do, then why would you not think everyone does? And the ache is there in every one of us in so many ways. And all you have to do is have a certain conviction and courage to pursue. And let me tell you, you'll begin to move into that. Once I move into something of the ache, and I'm not talking about the deepest levels of ache of a person's life. Remember what session we're talking about? Session one. So I'm quite aware I'm dealing on a very, very, very external, though internal, focus. As I move toward the ache, I want to use the ache to take me to what I want to call life responses. That's the third transition. From the inner ache to something of, how do they handle that? How do they deal with that? And from that to a fourth point, and that is the response can now be generalized into patterns. That's the fourth transition. Patterns of, how do you handle, is this how you handle other relationships? When you feel that kind of ache inside, is that, do you normally handle it by fill in the blank? Now, if I can do that in a first session, I'm a wizard. It doesn't mean that you're going to do it, but that's what you want to do, to move from external to internal, internal to feelings, feelings to an ache, ache to a response. How does that person respond? And then eventually to being able to draw it into patterns. What for? What am I trying to do? I'm trying to begin the process of making a shift that will be disruptive. A shift in every case orients the client to what really must be addressed in their life. And that's not their situation or their externals, but to their internals. By using the scenes that they describe, that put words or clothe the presenting problem with a certain degree of flesh, that will allow me to begin to put words to what I'll now call their thematic focus. If I can come to the end of the first session with the word pattern, and to be able to say, it seems like in many ways you come across as a very hard woman. And if I have the data that I've been able to gain and glean in a slow way, moving from external to internal, internal to feelings, feelings to an ache, ache to a response, response to larger patterns. If I've gone slowly and built a deductive, almost like a lawyer, building your database, then by the time we get to the end of the first session, if I can say to you, it seems in certain ways as if you go about living by fill in the blank. So now, rather than it being, you are here because you have problems with your husband. That's what my client began with. But if now they end with a sense of, I'm here because with my husband and likely with others, I'm a hard woman. Do you see what a marvelous transition has been made? That's what I want to do. I can't deal with your husband, your marriage. But what can I deal with? The first major category, style of relating. If I can put a phrase, a word, a sentence to your style of relating by the end of the first sentence in a way that you say, huh, yeah, to a degree where I can say, yes, we're going to work on your marriage, but we can't work on your marriage unless we have access to dealing with the way you come across with others. In other words, I've made the issues now personal. I've made them internal. I've made them personal, I've made them internal, and I've made them relational. If I've done that, then at some level, with God, I can rejoice in terms of saying, that was a grand first session. What's the outcome, ultimately, I want? And I'll end in 1 minute. First, I want my client to walk away comforted. I want my client to walk away from my first session with them with a sense of comfort, and that comfort being a sense of, I've been heard. I've been heard at levels that I didn't even know existed within me. And again, we're not talking about extravagant hearing. I'm just talking about, you heard that I said, Larry said at one point to Joan, it's almost like you sag. The word sag is such a better word than the word tired. You seem tired. You're sagging. It just has a much more powerful feel to it. In a sense, if a client's been heard, person's felt heard, you've listened to my words, you've interacted with curiosity, you've, in one sense, probed me. And probed me with kindness, not with a didactic, clinical data-taking. And if you want my one outlandish statement, don't ever take data with a client. Have you ever had a physician or anyone else take data from you? How old are you? Marital status? That's what I hear a lot of young counselors doing with clients. How long have you been married? How many kids do you have? How's your relationship? If in any way you sound like a clinician, then you've left being a human being. There's something about being in the position of being a counselor. We do this in our labs where we'll put one student as a counselor talking to another student as a client. And these are nice people who talk well with one another. You put them in the role of being a counselor and a client, and it's almost like a metamorphosis occurs. And the person takes on the austerity of a counselor. And they, the shoulders come back. And it's not good. It's just not good. That's where I say, I've been heard and followed. I've been pursued. That's what I mean by I want my client leaving with some comfort. Second, I want my client leaving somber. I want my client leaving with a sense of being stretched. Now, if they're 5'5", I don't want them to feel now that they must be 6 foot. If they're 5'5", I want them to feel 5'6.5". I want another inch and a half beyond what you can endure. In other words, I want there to be a level of seriousness about what we're doing. And the seriousness will come to the degree that you articulate an inner world that must be faced that has to do with depravity, even if you never use that word or even use the word sin. If all you talk about is your response to others in the context of your pain, what you're implying is what you do matters. And that will create some sense of stretch. I want my client leaving comforted. I want them leaving somber. And if ideal of ideal, I want them having some sense of the uncanny. And I don't know how to develop that. I don't know how to develop a sense of transcendence with a client. In part because I don't know if I live with much transcendence in my own life as I drive to work or as I talk with friends. To whatever degree you know God, you'll offer a sense of transcendence. To whatever degree you know God, there will be something, and please hear this word well, there'll be something odd about you. There'll be something that doesn't quite fit with the culture. I don't mean you'll wear stripes and checks. But what I do mean is that there'll be something that is otherworldly about you. There'll be some mood about you that won't be pietistic. Frankly, it won't have a drop of obvious spirituality. It won't be a sense of transcendence by praying at the end of the session, even though that's a very legitimate thing to do. The transcendence will come because at some degree, your client will know you have walked through the valley of the shadow of death, and you have found something about God that you want others to know. And therefore, you won't have to put it quickly. You won't have to put it directly. It can come with a degree of paradox, surprise. It can come with story and parable and myth. It can come in a context where something about you is different than most of the people your client has met. That's what we want. We don't want just to deal with the past. We don't want them just to have a hope that is a comfort. But we want them to have a sense of, if you're going to deal with me, at some level, though I know God so little, if you deal with me, somehow we're going to know God better. That must be the mood that is there. In which case, I think your client's going to leave unsure but hopeful. Unsure but hopeful. And therefore, anticipating the second session. I lied. I'm over 9. See you tomorrow.